We'll launch the May 16th, 2008 edition of the Rain Report in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome to another Rain Report. I'm Dwayne Whittingham, N9SSN. Depending upon when you'll be hearing this program, either on therainreport.com or via telephone at 773-358-7845, the Rain staff will either be huffing and puffing its way around Dayton Hamvention or recuperating from having done so all weekend. Therefore, as there's no one in the Rain production studio, including yours truly, at press time, we're going to take you back to February 2003 for a Rain rerun, introduced by longtime Rain script reader Blair Alper, KA9SEQ.
The morning of September 11th, 2001 will be forever etched in the hearts of mankind worldwide. Another will be February 1st, 2003, the morning the NASA shuttle Columbia disintegrated 40 miles above the Great Southwest, taking with it 7 astronauts, Dave Brown, Rick Husband, Laurel Clark, Kaplana Chavla, Michael Anderson, William McCool, and Elan Ramon. We dedicate this Rain Report to those courageous men and women, 3 of whom were ham operators, Dave Brown, KC5ZTC, Laurel Clark, KC5ZSU, and Kaplana Chavla, KD5ESI. 2003 marks 20 years ham radio has been in space. The first ham in space was Owen Garriott, W5LFL. This is his story.
For me, it's a real pleasure to have a chance to talk with this whole room full of young people who are already have a personal commitment and interest to amateur radio. Ham radio for me has always been a lot of fun, and I usually have a chance to talk with young people, only a small fraction of whom really understand what it's all about and are already motivated to think in these terms and want to advance their knowledge of the area. So it's a real privilege to talk to so many people who are already at the same level that most adults don't reach until they're much older. I thought perhaps it would be of interest to you all if I told you a little bit about how I became interested in ham radio. At about the same time, I was the age of many of you people in this room. I have been a ham for over 50 years. And so I was about your age when I first began to get interested in it in the following way. I remember my father came home one evening. He was working as a chemist, and he said, a friend of mine is going to be teaching a radio theory class 3 nights a week for the next semester or so, and I thought I would go, and would you be interested in coming along with me? I went, wow, you know, here's a chance to work with my father, attend some meetings with him, actually a chance to learn something new that I hadn't thought about. So I said, sure, Dad, I would like to do that. And so we then went to this code theory class for about a semester and learned the basic fundamentals of electrical circuits and this sort of thing, beyond what a technician license would require now. But still in those days, it was a fairly simple beginning to what would be required. And about the time we finished that, he came home another evening and said, well, I have something else that might be of interest to you. This same friend of mine who has been teaching the class is a member of the local amateur radio club, and they're going to be giving code classes Thursday nights for an indefinite period and teach everyone the fundamentals of learning the code, as we can hear in the back corner of the room over here. And so would you like to come along with me to that as well? I thought, sure, that sounds fine. I enjoyed the theory class, and learning the code did not seem all that challenging. And so we then went together to learn the code as well. And after about a year of this, my father and I managed to get our amateur radio licenses together. We went down and took the exam. I think he was more worried than I was. I think he was a little afraid that his son would pass and he might not. And I did have an easier facility with the code, I think. It seemed to be a little bit easier for a younger person to learn and to become comfortable with than it did my father. He was a pretty old man at the time. He must have been probably 35 to 40 years old. But at any rate, we managed to both pass our licenses on the first time. Then we continued to operate for a good many years after that as well. Now, I tell that not only because it might be of some interest to you, and there could be even some similarity in the way your interest and my interest developed when I was a teenager, but it has really affected my entire professional career since that time. Because this happened to me when I was just getting out of junior high school and into high school. The more I learned about it, I naturally had to talk about, well, how far can I reach somebody? My first contact from Enid, Oklahoma, which is where I grew up, was way over in Louisiana. I think his call was W5LAK, and that was quite a distance. I had a wire strung out my window attached to the garage corner. No idea what the standing wave ratio was. I'm not even sure I would have understood the process very, the concept very carefully, but it worked enough to radiate a little bit that I could communicate around on 80 meters. Thinking about radio propagation required that I also think, well, what am I going to do when I go to college? Well, it led me into the direction of electrical engineering, which I then, when I went to University of Oklahoma, I pursued that as a bachelor's degree. And then when I had to do 3 years in the Navy because of an ROTC commitment, but when I got out, I said, well, I really want to go to graduate school instead of be a professional Navy pilot or stay in the service. I want to go back to graduate school, and Stanford University was a good opportunity for me. And they fortunately had a radio propagation laboratory. And so immediately my amateur radio experience enabled me to gain some knowledge about what radio propagation was all about. It was right at the time of the International Geophysical Year, and as it turned out, probably three-quarters of the faculty in this particular laboratory at Stanford were already hams. And so it enabled them to know what kind of a background I had, know what kind of interests I had. Not only was I admitted to the university, but I even had a research assistantship right from the beginning, which was very important to me, because that's naturally important with a young person in a growing family as to how they're going to pay for all of this.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.rainreport.com.
Well, you can see that the radio propagation experience had led me right through the graduate program I had as soon as I got out of the U.S. Navy. I remember the date October 4th, 1957 very clearly. Well, I happened to have been a graduate student looking for a research dissertation topic when we all of a sudden heard that the Russians have just put up a satellite that's beeping away at 20 megahertz and 40 megahertz. Well, all of us being in the radio propagation laboratory converged on the field site. We listened to the satellite go by and by. Strange things were heard. Some of the first things, for example, you can immediately notice the Doppler shift, so you understood why that was there. There was also some very unusual fading. The signal amplitude would come up and go down, and come up and go down. Now, that was a puzzle to us. We hadn't thought about it before, and had no idea that this was the kind of thing that we might learn to expect. And I expect that many of you already know what that amplitude oscillation was supposed to be. Put two antennas out, they both oscillated, but in quadrature, if the antennas were perpendicular. Well, this began to give you a clue that, yes, indeed, the polarization was rotating. I need a dissertation topic. And so I managed to acquire that because I happened to be at the right spot at the right time, a fairly interesting and not too difficult task to interpret what all of this was about. We learned a good deal about the Earth's ionosphere by simply looking at the amplitude fluctuations of the signals that came down from Sputnik. So you can see how my father's visit way back in junior high school was a very important one to me, not only from my interest at the time, but my whole future professional development after that. From my research on those satellites came a selection by NASA. A few years later, I was on the faculty there for 5 years before NASA was finally around to selecting people with research backgrounds to fly in space. Well, I'd already been doing work for NASA on studying the ionosphere for several years, so fortunately, again, being at the right spot, right time, I was selected in the first group of scientist astronauts. Spent 20 years with NASA and did have the chance to fly on two flights. First one was in Skylab in 1973 for 2 months, and then on the first Space Lab on a shuttle flight, which was only 10 days. That's as long as the shuttle had ever flown at that point. So unfortunately, they have to live on fuel cell energy and have to come back rather often, whereas Skylab lived on solar energy and could stay there for a longer period. Skylab, we tried to get a ham radio equipment on board, couldn't do it. One of the main problems, not the only one, was the difficulty of a penetration through the pressure hull to get the RF signal out to space. We solved that on Spacelab 10 years later by not having to do that. We put an antenna to the window, so we just simply radiated out this little cavity resonator with a 2-meter signal into space. We avoided any interaction with the power sources on the spacecraft by carrying along our own batteries. And so in this way, we defused almost all of the safety items or conflicts that might have arisen with the spacecraft systems. I think none of us had any idea how well this would have been received, not only by the ham community, which we expected, but by the general public and by NASA when they found out what an important impact it could have, not only from a public relations standpoint, but also from an educational standpoint, from what it meant to really inspiring interest among young people as well as adults in the technical aspects of spaceflight, the technical aspects of amateur radio, and their whole general enthusiasm for scientific and technical progress. So there were only two hams in the astronaut office at the time we got this started, myself and Tony England, who flew on the second amateur radio experiment in space. Since that time, largely through some of the help at the folks at JSC, including Matt Bordelon, who is back here with us now, there have now been 86 astronauts who have qualified for a technician's or higher license. 24 missions have amateur equipment on board and flown with these kind of connections. One entire crew, every member, was an amateur. And there'll still be another one here ahead of us before we get to space station. So it has been a very positive influence. Not because we realized this when we began, but simply because it was found to be so much fun and so rewarding and so valuable to NASA and to the educational communities that people wanted to do it. And it has simply grown, as you can see, in extremely rapid fashion. The same thing is also true of the international experience. The Russians have it on Mir. It's up there right now. We're going to have it on space station. In some ways, even more important, the longer flights, like Skylab, 1, 2, 3 months, is now even going to be amplified larger to 3 to 6 month tours. People up there are going to need to have continuous communication back home, not continuous in terms of 24 hours a day, but frequent communication with their families. Ham radio provides an ideal way in which that can be done. And so I think from the standpoint of the crew health and welfare, from the standpoint of the interaction with the public back home, amateur radio should be expected to expand even beyond what we've seen already. But I've gone through a fairly lengthy story here to show you how important it was for me to begin to first of all understand and be interested and grow into an amateur radio environment. Ham radio has really meant a lot to me for my whole career.
Owen Garriott, W5LFL, who became the first ham in space, his biographical talk was presented at the 1999 Dayton Hamvention in Dayton, Ohio. As a postscript to this salute to the lives of the 5 men and 2 women who perished aboard Columbia February 1st, it seems only fitting that I tell you that the NASA shuttle Owen Garriott rode into space 20 years ago was none other than the ill-fated Columbia.
And that concludes this Rain rerun from February 2003. Next week, our plan is to bring you the first of several excerpts from the FCC forum. Those will be the first of numerous excerpts you'll be hearing for much of the next year from the 2008 Dayton Hamvention. Now for Hap Holly, KC9RP, Rain's founder and producer, I'm Dwayne Whittingham, N9SSN, bidding you a very 73 from all of us at Rain, the Radio Amateur Information Network, www.therainreport.com.